I guess we can get started now. I forgot to bring the clock down. See, out of practice. I'm going to have to use my clock here. So, a number of years ago, and I don't know who might remember this. Marty would remember it, probably Jay. Maybe Bonnie. Is Bonnie on? I can't tell. I did a series on Islamic theology and philosophy. Remember that? And it was not long after 9/11. It was like in the early 2000s or something.
Yes, I remember it.
Yeah.
Me too.
And
I don't think I was here yet.
Okay.
It was in 2003.
How do you happen to know that?
Well, in my notes, my notebooks.
Oh,
I do. I'm a host, though.
Well, anyway.
Not sure how this is happening.
So, I
can't do it. Usually, if you tap the screen, a black bar will
come up. Somebody need to mute. In that series, I went over, the theme of the series was really the cycle, which repeated itself three times, of sort of liberalizing movements within Islamic thought, and then conservative reactions against the liberalizing movements. And we started off with the Mu'tazilites, which were the earliest theological group in Islam, who contended strongly that the Quran needed to be interpreted metaphorically, that sort of thing. And then the reaction against that was around a theologian by the name of al-Ash'ari, who founded the Asharite school, which is the dominant school of theology in the Islamic Middle Ages. And then that was followed in turn by an efflorescence of philosophical thought, because during the 9th century, a lot of translation efforts had been going on to translate, especially the works of Aristotle, from Greek into Arabic. And also, along with those works of Aristotle, some passages from Plotinus's Aeneids got circulated under the title of the Theology of Aristotle. So that's how some Neoplatonism wound up in the Aristotelian synthesis of the medieval Islamic philosophers. But anyway, you had this explosion of philosophy from the 10th to the 12th century in the Islamic world. But that was pretty much put an end to by the greatest theologian of Islam, I think everybody would agree, who was Al-Ghazali, who died in 1111. It's a very easy date to remember. Who actually took the trouble to master the ideas of people like Al-Farabi and Ibn Sina, and then wrote a refutation of those ideas in which he tried to enlist the aid of skepticism and sort of reason, you know, undermining itself, so to speak, in favor of revelation. So that was the second cycle. And then the third cycle was within the Sufi movement, which I think from a Western perspective probably is the most attractive intellectual movement within Islam, because the Sufis were they were very sort of quietistic. Sufism is the mystical side of Islam. And they were very quietistic and very tolerant. We talked about Ibn al-Arabi and his Bezels of Wisdom. That was sort of the text I used there. But then again, in the 13th and 14th century, there was a reaction against that in the person of mostly Ibn Taymiyyah, who in turn became sort of the intellectual ancestor of the Wahhabi movement. And so that's where I sort of ended that story of the three cycles of liberalization and conservative reaction. So that was the last time that we talked about Islam in this class. So that was, 17 years ago. But I never did talk about the Quran. And so I thought I would remedy that, and I thought that would be of interest to people. I think people are probably tired of the existentialists. I'm tired of the existentialists. And so I thought that would be of interest to people to do something completely different and talk about the Quran, because my independent study student that I referred to earlier, Randy Jocelyn, and I guess she didn't make it. I guess she said she had a conflict and she didn't know if she could resolve it. But anyway, a number of years ago, she and I read the Quran, and she, it was her idea. And so, and the smart thing we did, the thing that was really smart, is we read the surahs of the Quran in chronological order. The surahs are the chapters. The Quran has 114 surahs in it. And we read them not in the order from first to last. I mean, this is my copy right here of the Quran. And we did not read it, you know, from cover to cover. Instead, we read it, well, we read everything, but I mean, not in that order. We read the surahs in chronological order. You might say, well, how do we know what the chronological order was? And I think that's probably a lot of the time based on what we know of the history of Muhammad, plus internal evidence inside the Quran itself. Now, what we used was the so-called Egyptian chronology, which is the traditional chronological order. There have been other attempts at establishing the chronology of the surahs in the Quran. I'm not an expert in this, so this is kind of outsider looking in. But my sense is that those other chronologies don't really differ that radically from the traditional Egyptian chronology. So I get the sense that there is a fairly substantial agreement as to the general order of the surahs in the Quran. The reason I said that was a good idea, and I don't remember if it was her idea or my idea, probably her idea, is that if you aspire at some point to read the Quran, and it's not terribly long. I mean, it's a little bit shorter than the New Testament, so it's not, you know, not that hard, and it's certainly not hard reading. But if you do aspire to do that, I would certainly advise doing the same thing. It makes a lot more sense if you read them in chronological order, because there indeed is a sort of development of ideas, and you can get a feel for that if you use the chronology as opposed to just, you know, page one to page whatever. It really makes it more, it makes it more intelligible, I think, to a non-Muslim to read them in the supposedly chronological order. So that's what we did, and I profited a lot from that. By the way, I'm going to talk about my spreadsheet in a few minutes, some more, but I have this spreadsheet that I put together, and I will send everybody the spreadsheet, and one of the things in the spreadsheet is the Egyptian chronology. So that will, if you, as I say, ever want to do that, you can use my spreadsheet to figure out what the chronology is. The dumb thing I did was not taking any notes. If I had some notes, it would have made this whole thing a lot easier. But I spent a good bit of the summer reviewing the Quran, thinking a lot about how best to present it, which I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, because it's not obvious what the best way is to present the Quran. Certainly, what I'm not going to do is just start with surah number whatever, the first one, 96, I think it is, and go chronologically through, and because the Quran is very repetitive, and by the time we hit our fifth week or something, you'd be yawning and you'd say, well, I think I've heard that like five times before. So I'm not going to do that, but I will spend a few minutes talking about how I do plan to do the review of the Quran after I cover a couple of philological points that I thought I would start off with. And philological points because I don't know a great deal about, well, I mean, I don't know Arabic, so I certainly don't know the intricacies of some of these controversies, but I wanted you to be aware of that they're out there. And I'll say what I think as an outsider looking in about some of these points. And by the way, both of these philological issues in some parts of the world are dangerous, literally dangerous to broach. because they regard as an open question issues that a conservative would say have long been settled by orthodoxy. The first question that some scholars raise is whether Muhammad actually was the author of the Quran, or whether he was the only author of the Quran. As I say, I don't know the intricacies of the whole controversy, but anyway, some have suggested that maybe there were multiple authors of the Quran and that it was put together somewhat later than it's traditionally, said to have been put together. Now, I can tell you my reaction to that. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, the Quran is extremely repetitive. You read these surahs, and by the time you get to, the 40th one or something in chronological order, you've hit the same ideas probably 10 times up to that point. It seems to me that in and of itself would suggest that there's a single author rather than multiple authors. The other thing that is, to my way of thinking, suggestive of single authorship is just how things get developed as you read the surahs in chronological order. And I mentioned a minute ago that there is indeed a development of ideas as you go through. What are stated, the kinds of things that are stated in almost outline fashion at the beginning, as you get farther and farther through, begin being fleshed out a lot more in a lot more detail. Connected ideas start getting linked in. It seems to me that that's the kind of thing that one would expect from a single author who wrote over a period of maybe 20 years at most, and began, I shouldn't say wrote, composed, I'll explain that word in a minute, composed over a period of somewhat less than two decades, and began the process of composition in his early 40s. Let me give you two examples of what I'm thinking about to illustrate my contention here. Let's look at somebody like Plotinus, the great Neoplatonist who lived in the 3rd century. Porphyry, his biographer, tells us that Plotinus began writing at age 49, and we know that Plotinus lived until he was 66, so he wrote over a period of, 17, 18 years, something like that. When we look at the Aeneids, when we read them, and we also know the chronological order of that work as well, and so when we read the treatises in the Aeneids in chronological order, what we find is this. We find the earliest treatises to be kind of short and presenting the general overview of Plotinus' system. And as you go farther and farther and farther chronologically through the treatises, the treatises become more complex, a lot more details are filled in, links with other ideas get established, but no fundamental revision in Plotinus' worldview. Contrast that with, say, Plato. Plato began his writing probably in his late 20s. He lived to 80, which means that his writing career spanned over half a century. There is an enormous change. If you look at the very earliest dialogues, we think we know what the rough order was. If you look at the very earliest dialogues, and even if you get to the middle dialogues, let alone the late ones, there is an enormous change in Plato's point of view. Well, my point is that Muhammad, or the Quran, is a lot more like Plotinus than it is like Plato. Here we have somebody who, like Plotinus, began composing fairly late in life. His early 40s as opposed to Plotinus' late 40s, but, close. Muhammad died at age 62. Plotinus died at age 66. So, it's very, just lifespan-wise, it's very close to what we find in Plotinus. And we find the same pattern in the Quran, as we find in Plotinus, in the sense that there is no wholesale revision in the general worldview. But there is a development of ideas over a period of about 20 years, or somewhat less than 20 years. And isn't that what you'd expect from somebody who's writing in, you know, 17-18 year period, or composing in that kind of time frame, and who began his compositions in his 40s? You know, people in, you know, writing in their 40s, between their 40s and their 60s, aren't going to change, most of the time, change their ideas radically, as opposed to somebody like Plato beginning in his 20s and living to age 80, you know. So because Muhammad, or the Quran, is a lot more like Plotinus' Aeneids than it is like Plato's dialogues. And what I see when I read the Aeneids, I see something very similar to what we see when we read the surahs of the Quran in chronological order. So, as an outsider looking in, that strikes me as, you know, plausible. And so, in other words, the traditional picture of Muhammad as the sole author of the Quran strikes me as plausible for the reasons I just said. Now, I say, and I'm not an expert, but that's the way it seems to me, in a naive sort of way. So that's the first philological point that I wanted to just mention, and I'm going to drop, from now on, I'm going to assume that Muhammad indeed was the author of the Quran. When I say, oh, by the way, remember I said I would comment on the word composed. Traditionally, Muhammad is said to have been illiterate. So that means that, you know, he got these revelations, he had these visions of the angel Gabriel reciting some part of the Quran to him, and then he would, you know, he had somebody who was literate, an amanuensis, a scribe or something like that, and he would recite that back, and somebody would write it down on some sort of, you know, bark or leaf or papyrus or something or other, and you know, that's how the Quran supposedly got composed, through these revelations and his oral recitation to somebody who would actually write it all down. I'll talk about that more in a minute.
Hey Don, this is Tom.
Yeah.
I read some stuff a few weeks ago trying to prepare for this class, and I came to the opposite conclusion about the authorship.
Okay.
It seemed I read pretty convincing to me, also naive, that it was multiple authors over multiple centuries.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So,
I mean, okay, do you remember what the arguments
were? Well, one of the examples was, according to the things I read, was the amount of reference to Jewish and Christian things that Muhammad would unlikely have known.
Okay, you don't remember.
But Don, you said it was a controversy, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the things that pop into my mind are things that I think he would have known, but I mean, I don't know. I'd be curious to know what they're talking about, because the things that I mean, there are many references to Judaism and Christianity in the Quran, and at least the ones having to do with Christianity, a lot of them have to do with Christian theology. But in the 7th century, Christian theology, at least the Orthodoxy, was getting fairly well established. I don't know. I'd like to see the details. Maybe you can send me a link. Was this online?
There's quite a bit online.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I read some of the stuff online as well. Why don't you send me a link to whatever it was you found, probably.
But, you know, it reminded me some of the discussions we've had in your class about who wrote the Christian Bible well and when.
Yeah, I know.
You know, how much was, you know, if you want to be uncharitable, how much was made up and how much was divinely inspired,
right.
All that stuff.
Right,
it sounded similar.
Right. Well, anyway, I've stated the reasons why to me it seems like it's, you know, single authorship, but, you know, I could be wrong. Go ahead.
Getting back to the theme of composition, the word Quran itself means recitations.
Yeah. So that, yeah, That's sort of in the title, isn't it? The other philological point is the issue of whether there are variants in the text. And a lot of scholars, and I think this is likely, a lot of scholars think that early on there were multiple Qurans out there. That's putting it a little too extreme, I suppose. But multiple, there were a lot of textual variants and maybe verses that are not in the Quran that we have, and so forth and so on. The Quran as we know it was put together, the official edition, so to speak, was supposedly put together about 20 years after Muhammad died. So that would have been in the mid-7th century. And so these scholars hold that, you know, early on there were lots of variants out there, but when the official edition was put together, then the other variants were suppressed, and so we have this supposedly unitary tradition. Now, of course, that flies right in the face of orthodoxy, because orthodoxy holds, and this is something we have to get used to, orthodoxy holds that the Quran has existed from eternity in heaven, physically. It's physically in heaven from eternity. It never was, never began. It's the Muslim doctrine of the Logos. Literally, the Word of God is eternal, just as in the Christian tradition, eternal, but it's not a person of the Trinity or anything like that. It's literally a book or a part of a larger book. And anyway, the tradition holds that, as I said, the angel Gabriel came down on multiple occasions, many, many occasions. I guess 114 occasions, because there are 114 surahs, and revealed to Muhammad, you know, blah, 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 blah. Muhammad had it all down. I don't know if somebody was with him at the time, and he would simply, you know, maybe later on, maybe that was the case. But at any rate, his transmission of the revelation from Gabriel to somebody who could write it down was flawless. The scribe made no mistakes in writing it down. There was never any variance in the text. The text that we have now is the perfect duplicate of what exists from eternity in heaven. There's never been a mistake. That's the orthodox position. So, of course, to suggest that, you know, there were variants in the text and whatever, flies right in the face of that. But, you know, there is no ancient work that there aren't a lot of variants. That's what scholars try to deal with when they put together critical editions. You know, they take all the extant versions of something, compare them, decide what's the most plausible, what's the most plausible version of this. They put that out, and then in the apparatus at the bottom of the page, they list all the variants so that other people can make up their own minds about it. There's no work that is not like that. But, of course, maybe an orthodox person would simply say, well, that just shows the Quran is special, right? Because there's never been an issue with the text. Okay, whatever. At any rate, the question of authorship and the question of textual variants are two philological issues that you find discussed out there, but I simply want to mention them, and I won't be dealing with them in the ensuing weeks, because we're going to have a much higher level look at the Quran. I'm not going to get lost in the weeds. I don't think that would be an effective way of presenting what's in there. Okay, so far, any other questions or comments? Okay. All right, so the next thing I want to ask, the next question I want to ask myself is, what's the best way of presenting this work, the Quran? And I want to tell you about my thought process over the summer. I spent a lot of time this summer thinking about it, working on it. I have this spreadsheet that's got a lot of stuff in it. And initially, what I thought was, Because, of course, the thing that just strikes you always, if you read it, is as I said 1,000 times now, how repetitive it is. I'm being repetitive in saying that it's repetitive, but that is very prominent when you go through. So I thought, okay, well, then maybe the best way to do it is to identify maybe 20 or so themes, and use those themes. And then read representative passages to illustrate those various themes. So I embarked, that's when I first created my spreadsheet. So I embarked on this little research project. And now it turns out that somebody or some bodies went through the Quran and, good thing for us, took some of the longer surahs and divided them up into subsections, which is nice. I mean, the longest surah, I think it's got like 40 or something like that. The real short ones really are only one section long, but if it's of any length at all, it's very convenient for us to have sections in there. So I thought, this was my bright idea originally. So I thought, okay, what I'll do is I'll create this spreadsheet. There are like 558 sections altogether, I think. I'll create this spreadsheet, and I'll list all the sections, and I will then list the topic that each section deals with. That seems reasonable. And so I did that. But then I found online somebody else who did the same thing, and for the same reason. This guy, he said, okay, the Quran's very repetitive. So what I did, this guy says, what I did was I had read it already, but I sat down and reread it with my pencil in my hand, and I annotated in the margins the topic that each, thing was, I don't know if he did it quite as systematically as I did, but anyway, annotated in the margins, which, by the way, no Muslim would ever do. You'd never deface your Quran, but anyway, he's not a Muslim. So, and then he presented his topics. Well, you know what? His topics and my topics were not all very much alike. And it was partly thinking through his topics that I changed my focus on how I would do this presentation. Because his topic, the main criticism I would have of the way he was presenting it is that he was looking at the Quran through the eyes of a 21st century American Christian. And the concerns of a 21st century American Christian are not going to be the same concerns as a 7th century Arab. I mean, that is just fundamental. That's, of course, when you're approaching history, I suppose that's the most common mistake that you find out there. Just assuming that somehow our own age is the fulcrum point from which everything else is evaluated, assuming that our age is the standard and everything else is a deviation to one degree or another from the standard, which is my concerns as a 21st century American Christian. So, for example, everybody wants to know about jihad, right? Because after 9/11, everybody wants to know about jihad. What does the Quran say about jihad? Well, the Quran does have passages mentioning jihad, and you find these interminable and fruitless debates online where, Christians come in and say, look, the Quran says this and this and this and this about, holy war, and Muslims, they'll say, no, you're taking it out of context, and then the other guys will come back and say, no, you're taking it. I mean, these debates never get resolved because the first principle in all cases is either the Quran is false or the Quran is true. But the fact of the matter is, yes, of course the Quran has something to say about jihad. But look, the Quran is not about jihad. It's not about jihad. I mean, jihad gets in there. It's one of the subsidiary themes, as many things are subsidiary. But you cannot say that the main theme of the Quran is holy war. Nor can you say that the main theme of the Quran is the status of women. That's another big one, right? That's something we worry about a lot, in our 21st century Methodist church, we talk about that quite a bit. But is the whole point of the Quran to talk about the status of women? No. Of course it comes up, mostly in the context of laws dealing with the family and stuff like that. But that's just not the main point of the Quran. Isn't it a lot fairer when you're talking about a text to try to talk about it on its own terms rather than other topics that to us, from our particular point in history, may seem really important? Because what's important to us was not necessarily what was important to somebody living in 7th century Arabia. So that line of thinking led me to where I should have gone on from the start, to ask myself the question, okay, what is then the main theme of the Quran? You know? And this is how I explain my, or how I rationalize away my lack of expertise in not knowing Arabic, and I'm not an expert in, you know, Islam, certainly. But I do have the ability, I think I do, to not confuse the forest with the trees. And what we want to talk about here is the forest. We want to see what the big picture is. What is it that Muhammad is saying in the Quran? If you go through the whole thing, you know, what's the main message? Now, of course, a lot of other things are satellites around that sun, so to speak. You know, a lot of things come up in the context of talking about the main message, of course, as is always the case. I mean, once again, take an analogy with Plotinus. You know, what's the main message in the Aeneid? Well, his three primal hypostases and the nature of each of those three, but then they bring in a lot of other issues that kind of hang off that main trunk of the tree. Well, the same thing here. We have a main trunk of the tree. Well, yeah, there are other issues that branch off of it, and we'll visit them. But I'm not going to lose sight of the main trunk. So, the question is, what then is the main trunk? what is it that strikes me, after having read it and after having studied it a bit, what is it that strikes me as the main message that Muhammad wants to convey, or that God wants to convey through Gabriel, through Muhammad, to the world, you know? And I would say the theme is prophethood. I think I put that in the little blurb that was in the messenger. Prophethood. Prophethood. Why prophethood? Well, we have to picture, as a necessary condition for this, picture God as perfectly just. Picture God as perfectly just. Because God is perfectly just, God has certain expectations for the human race. God has these ideas that this is the right way to live, very strongly held ideas, I might add. This is the right way to live. Therefore, those are expectations for what we should do in our own lives. And by the way, when I say we, really the focus in the Quran is not on individuals so much as groups, interestingly. We'll see that. But anyway, so there are expectations then for these various groups out there on the earth as to how they should live their lives because God is perfectly just. Now, because God is perfectly just, it wouldn't be very fair, would it, to evaluate those groups on criteria that were not announced beforehand, right? It's not very fair to evaluate somebody on a set of criteria and you never tell the person or those people what the criteria are. I once had a professor. Patty's going to get on me for this. This is not what she's thinking about. This is back at Wake Forest, but I had a religion professor. I never did do very well in religion. Here I am teaching Sunday school. But anyway, This was a new, I should have had a different, I should have signed up. I could have signed up for a different guy, and I signed up for this other guy. Well, turns out, this is New Testament. Turns out, this guy, we had, I don't know how many tests in the semester. I don't know if it's just midterm and finals, but probably, I think a few more. But anyway, what he would do was, he would give like 7 questions or something like that. You had to answer 4 of 7 or something. I don't remember exactly. 3 or 5, I don't know, whatever. And so, you'd do it, you'd write in your blue book and so forth and so on. What he didn't tell people, though, and this is just wrong, he didn't tell people that those questions, he rated those questions in terms of difficulty, and if you attacked a more difficult question, you'd get a higher grade. Now, of course, I had no idea, so I would simply go in and probably I always answered the easiest questions because I thought, I know that and I know that. Now, that's not fair, right? It's not fair to grade students on something that you don't even tell them what you're grading them on, i.e. the difficulty of the question that you ask. Well, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. It wouldn't be fair if God did not announce ahead of time to these people out there what indeed God's expectations were for their life. So we need prophets to do that. Another name for prophet is messenger. Right? They're messengers of God's criteria to human beings. And yet another name for prophet is warner, which I think is a very revealing name. Prophets are warners. They're warners. Because part of the message is, you better shape up. And, as a matter of fact, to follow up that thought, because God is perfectly just, you get your warnings out there. Well, like it's like, okay, I'll come back in 24 hours and see where you stand. If you shape up, you will be rewarded beyond your most wildest expectations. The gardens in heaven, words fail me to express the beauty, the pleasure, the utter happiness of living in the gardens in heaven. But if you do not live up to those expectations, you will be punished so severely that every second from now until eternity, you will wish you had never been born. It's kind of one extreme or the other. But why? Because God is perfectly just. You shape up, you'll be rewarded. You don't shape up, you'll be punished. Simple as that. Very different from, say, Origenian theology, the Christian tradition, where God is kind of infinitely patient. You screw up once and God, give it another chance. You screw up again, you get another chance. You screw up again, you get another chance, and so forth and so on. Of course, that's emphasizing God's benevolence. And if God is completely benevolent, even in Origen, God is not completely benevolent. But if God is completely benevolent, then God is not really just. Because, everybody gets ultimately rewarded. Jerome used to complain about that with Origen. In an era where sexuality was so frowned upon, he would complain that, virgins would be no better off than prostitutes at the end of time. But if God is completely just, as he certainly is in the Quran, then you can't say that God is really benevolent. I mean, the people who get damned, that's not exactly benevolent, is it? So, anyway, but I'm getting off the subject. The whole point, though, is that's why we need prophets. We need prophets because God is absolutely just. And peoples need to be warned. And then when the time comes to put these peoples in the balance, there's this idea of the just balance, you know? Which way do they go? And because God is completely just, those who toe the line get rewarded, and those who don't get punished. So that's why prophethood is the central theme, at least in my reading of the Quran. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to look at the prophets. And the first prophet was Adam. Now you might say, whom did Adam prophesy to? Eve? Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, if he lived to be, what, 850 or 900 or whatever it was, I mean, he had plenty of great, great, great whatever to prophesy to, I suppose. Anyway, Adam's the first prophet. The last prophet, as you know, and the final prophet, the seal of the prophets, there will be no successors, is Muhammad. The second to last prophet is Jesus. If you go through and look at the 25 prophets, some of the names you would not recognize. Hud, Saleh, Su'eib, you would not recognize those names. But actually, they have been identified with biblical figures. Saleh is Methuselah, right, for example. And so if you hold those identifications, then of the 24 prophets prior to Muhammad, every single one of them is biblical. And of the 24, 3 are New Testament and 21 are Old Testament. So, which leads me to my next general topic before I get into the weeds. Well, before that, though, does anybody have any comments or questions or anything like that? So we're going to focus on the prophets. I mean, I'm going to start off. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the Quran and then read sections, because it's not hard reading. I don't have to summarize it. Read sections, and I'll start with Adam. The story's about Adam. And right on through, all through to Jesus and then Muhammad. So we're just going to go sequentially, all 25. And some of them, the Quran doesn't say much. I mean, it just sort of mentions their name, and that's that. But a lot of them, there's quite a bit of detail. Any questions so far?
Don, this is Tom. I have a question.
Okay.
Do you put any significance in the fact that the angel Gabriel was the intermediary as opposed to God speaking directly to Muhammad?
No, not really. I mean, no. Interestingly, you know, it reminds me of Maimonides. You know, Maimonides, the great Jewish philosopher of the 12th century, makes a big deal out of that. And he says, you know, most of the time it's mediated by an angel, but Moses, our master, got it directly from God. But no, I don't think that there's a sort of hierarchy here. The fact of the matter is, Gabriel got it perfectly right. You know, Gabriel didn't make any mistake, so that's okay.
Don?
Yeah.
So Muhammad was the last prophet before writing the Quran. Is there an expectation that there would be additional prophets?
No.
Or No,
he is the final prophet. The phrase is, he is the seal of the prophets. So it's like,
yeah, you can't follow perfection with someone else.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like you got the stamp here at this point. The Quran recognizes the Torah and the Gospel, i.e. the Bible as we know it. The Torah and the Gospel are mentioned repeatedly in the Quran. And as a matter of fact, that was the next thing I'm going to talk about, but I'm running out of time, so let me just... Well, I got 7 minutes. Not 7 minutes. I got to quit a little bit early. But one of the interesting things, as Christians, one of the, you know, even if you were, even if you couldn't care less about Islam, any Christian who's interested in church history should read the Quran, because it gives you a lot of insight into what Christian or any Jew who's interested in Jewish history, intellectual history of the Jewish faith, would also should read the Quran, because it gives you a lot of insight into what Judaism and Christianity were like in the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century. Allegedly, one of Muhammad's cousins was a Christian. There are lots of Christians and lots of Jews all over the place. In Yemen, what we now know as Yemen, there are a lot of Christians down there. Across the Red Sea and Aksum, ancient Ethiopia, that was a Christian kingdom. In fact, some of Muhammad's followers fled there once. I'll talk about the issues that he, when I get into talking about Muhammad's life, I'll talk about some of the controversies during his life. But, you know, when things were looking pretty bad, some of his followers actually fled to Aksum. So, I mean, there were a lot of opportunities for Muhammad to know quite a bit about both Judaism and Christianity. So you find these constant references to the Torah and the Gospel. That's how he puts it. We would think Old Testament, New Testament. And then there are gobs and gobs. Well, heck, I just told you, right? Of the 24 prophets preceding Muhammad, assuming you accept the identification of people like Saleh with Methuselah, you know, clearly it's all based on the Bible. And so as we go through all these people, it's going to be all familiar. Well, not all. A lot of familiar stuff in there. He has gobs and gobs and gobs to say about Abraham, about Moses, you know, quite a bit to say about Jesus. You know, these are major figures in his view. And so we will see a lot of biblical stories told in the Quran, although often with a twist. But that is revealing in and of itself, because it gives you an idea of what or the kinds of stories that were circulating in Arabia in the 7th century. You know, I'll close with this thought because it is getting a little bit late. Yeah, we got 4 minutes. We tend to think of Christianity, I think, as fairly monolithic. You know, Christianity has been around for 2,000 years. We think we've worked through a lot of things, and you know, we have this fixed idea. This is what Christianity is, period. Once again, we need to exercise a little bit of historical imagination and realize that in the 7th century, Christianity is a lot more fluid than we typically think. I mean, sure, you got what's in the Bible, but there were oral traditions, there were other writings, there was all sorts of stuff floating around, and some of that stuff floating around wound up in the Quran. And that's why, when you're reading the Quran, and you'll come across, you know, a story of this, that, or the other, and you'll think, oh, I know about that. And then you'll hit some detail or other, and you think, what? That's not right. Well, before we use that as a cudgel to bash Islam and say, well, Muhammad didn't even get his stories right, what we need to recognize is that Christianity of the 7th century was, you know, still fairly fluid. And there were these stories circulating out there that, you know, variants. You get the same impression from the Talmud. You know, you have these Midrashim, right? These stories that are based on Old Testament stories, but provide other details. And so it's similar to that, I think. Well, I will start off with that next week because it's worth exploring in a little more detail. What I'm going to talk about, let's see now, I've got this mental outline. So I'm going to continue with that, the Christianity that, or the Judaism and Christianity that one finds in the Quran. I'll talk about that some more. And then I'll talk about some of the peculiarities of this book so that you kind of know, if you do think about reading it sometime or parts of it, what to expect. You know, I said there are 114 surahs. I hadn't said anything about how long they are, what the order is. This is based on the various invocations that you find, the sort of the mystical. What is a verse that says Alif Lam Ra supposed to mean? You know, that kind of thing. So I'll talk about that, and then I'll talk about the life of Muhammad. And those are the six topics. I've talked about three of the six topics in my head. So I'm going to talk about probably next time. And then in 2 weeks, then we can actually start looking at what the Quran says about Adam, the first prophet, and go on from there. So I think, any last minute questions? Okay, I think we need to quit. I think that's a sign that we need to quit.
Thanks, Don.
Maybe from Gabriel. Probably Gabriel.
Thanks, Don.
Sure.